This is the Week in Review. We will review the state and national top news stories of the week and welcome your input, too. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, June the 3rd. We have with us two guests from different political perspectives who will discuss and debate the top news stories of the week. We welcome topics from you. We welcome input from you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guests. We have with us John Smart, who is vice chair of the Price County Democratic Party, joining us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And also in studio with us is John Sharpless, who is UW-Madison history professor. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to start with the story that led NPR News. Unemployment numbers. The Labor Department report is, according to this story, offering startling evidence that the U.S. economy is slowing. Employers hired only 54,000 new workers in May. That's the fewest in 8 months, and the unemployment rate rose to 9.1%. This economy just can't get going, can it, John Sharpless?
No, it can't. I think we've moved beyond the housing crisis. There's clearly some structural problems here. Japan went through this kind of thing about a decade ago, and they really have never come back. They have had rather persistent high unemployment. They have an enormous safety net that allows people to be unemployed and still continue fairly comfortable lifestyles. This is going to be a challenge for Obama as the year goes on. And he certainly has tried a lot of different things, but clearly it hasn't moved the economy. And the interesting thing is that the Fed has done all it can possibly do to loosen the money supply. And clearly lending institutions just don't trust the economy. So even though theoretically money should be cheap, it's not moving.
Yeah, and that's not good for the country or for President Obama, is it, John Smart?
No, of course it's not good for anybody at all. And everyone wishes that the economy would get moving faster. There are far too many causes for it for us to really sit down and start itemizing it. But it seemed like the economy was turning around, and I think it probably still is, but it's just not going to be a very fast turnaround, and we're going to have to deal with this for a while. As John just said, the financial institutions are hesitant to extend credit to allow businesses to expand. And businesses themselves are sitting on a great deal of capital, kind of afraid to expand because they don't know what the market is going to hold. And it's just too bad. And we do need to have something to kind of kick it all loose. And I'm not sure what that could be. And I also was concerned about the Japanese model, Professor Sharpless. That concerns me greatly because the Japanese did not handle their situation back in the 90s well at all.
Let me take a call from Mike in Appleton. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm glad you touched on this because I really think that this is the most important piece of news that there is. I mean, everything is related to this. If there are no jobs and there's no revenue and we can't pay down the debt, and, you know, this Obama administration, I think, has been an absolute disaster. And one of your guests just mentioned now, you know, there's, you know, what's the answer? The answer is to create confidence in the business people who are the people who are going to invest and, you know, little by little get the economy moving. But who in his right mind would make an investment now with a government that you don't know what they're going to do, that they say one thing one day, another thing the other? It's an absolute disaster.
All right. Well, let me let John Smart take this one first.
Yeah, it's quick. Everybody is quick to call this an absolute disaster. And I know that they get tired of hearing the story, but after all, it was a disaster that the Obama administration inherited, and that's the fact. And in the preceding years, in the Bush years, they relaxed taxes on the wealthy, and supposedly that was supposed to, back in the old trickle-down theory, that money was then supposed to be put into the economy, and businesses were supposed to expand, and work was supposed to be created, and jobs, and it did not happen. And so I'm not sure what the answer is either, and I don't think anybody really does. But I think that the president was on the right track and will continue on the right track, and we just have to work it through.
Mm-hmm. John Sharpless?
I don't think the president has a track. It is fair to say that much of this was inherited from Bush, from the Bush era. I want to be careful here. I think it's important for Americans to understand that in a modern economy, which is embedded in a world economy, presidents don't have a lever in the basement that they can pull and suddenly everything's either good or bad. A lot of the things that happened on Bush's watch had little or nothing to do with Bush, and a lot of things that are happening now has little or nothing to do with Obama. Both men are men of good conscience. Neither one of them wanted to see people unemployed. Neither one of them wanted to see people lose their houses. If they could have reversed it, they would have. I really think that in a global economy with things like rising oil prices, right when presidential policies are beginning to be manifested, another thing happens. As somebody who's a bit more on the right than more perhaps like Mike and Appleton, I don't think Obama has been as friendly to the business community that perhaps he should have. But I'm not sure that would have changed anything. The notion that if you cut taxes more, that suddenly there's going to be a flowering of entrepreneurial interest in America. We've tried that before. That model seems to be muddled in some way. It just hasn't worked the way Republicans have consistently argued that it should.
And John Sharpless, as a historian, President Obama does face a tough time getting reelected if the unemployment rate sticks around 9%, doesn't he?
He's got a major problem. I believe the magic number is 7.3. No president since FDR has been elected with an unemployment rate of 7.3. He's certainly aware of it. It isn't something like George Bush Sr., where for a while he seemed to be indifferent or at least confused on the plight of people in the economy. If you'll remember back when Clinton ran against Bush, they had a poster up in Clinton campaign headquarters that said the economy is stupid. It's quite clearly the economy. It always has been in American politics. It even overrides, in many cases, international crises. It'll override scandal. I don't know what he does. I think, in part, it will depend on the Republicans. Even if he's vulnerable and the Republicans fail to arrive at a candidate who can create consensus on the right and in the middle, he'll still win.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Mitt Romney officially tossed his hat into the ring and announced his candidacy for president yesterday, and his theme of his speech was that President Obama has failed the country. John Smart, ask you to react to Mitt Romney and whether or not you think he is now the instant front runner, or how you assess the field of GOP candidates.
Well, officially, I think he's the only runner, so I don't know what that means. But I think that the Republicans tend to be falling all over themselves. When Mitt Romney was in New Hampshire making his grand announcement, Sarah Palin showed up with her bus, and so did Rudy Giuliani to make a speech. It was like they were determined that that Mitt Romney was not going to steal the headlines if they could figure out a way to get them away from him. And I think that they've got a lot of sifting and winnowing to do before they come up with a viable candidate, and I don't know that it will be Mitt Romney.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Mitt Romney is a viable candidate, John Sharpless?
I think right now, if you look across all the people, the combination of a kind of presentation of a reasonable man, a man with business experience, having been a governor. I know that the right is awfully critical about him signing off on the Massachusetts plan, which has some similarities to Obamacare, but he can certainly weather that. He can say, I was giving it a try at reform, and whether it worked or not, I'll leave it to other people to decide. Within the party, there are many people on the right who don't think he's conservative enough. That will certainly shock Democrats. He had many years of being a moderate Republican, and he has spent his more recent history trying to move to the right to convince people on the right wing of the party that his credentials are sound. But his history as governor was very centrist.
So what were Sarah Palin and Donald Trump up to at that pizza parlor?
That's frightening, isn't it? I don't know if I want to ever go there for pizza. I don't know. I'm sure I'm going to anger some of the people out in conservative land here, but I just think they're a couple of clowns. They're media people. They're not political people. I don't know if any serious person wants that kind of figure in the White House. Donald Trump is clearly a wheeler dealer. He's had some great deals. He's made a lot of money. He's lost a lot of money. He's got a television show. Does that mean that you want him negotiating with top world leaders? And I think, you know, Sarah's an attractive, bright, energetic woman with a great style. But again, I think she's aimed to be her style is more suitable for being a talk show host on Fox television than it is for being in the White House.
Yeah. And Donald Trump said he's not going to run for president, but Sarah Palin has not ruled it out, and she's, you know, on this this tour of states that are important in the nomination process. John Smart, what do you make of this?
Well, Donald Trump did come out and say, I think it was yesterday, that, well, he might have to change his mind and get back into the race if somebody better doesn't come along. So I don't know that we've heard the end of Donald Trump yet. And I can't resist repeating a line from Bill Maher, who said something. Somebody asked him about Michelle Bachmann, and he said, Michelle Bachmann is the candidate for people who find Sarah Palin too intellectual.
When I asked about Mitt Romney, John Smart, you said he's the only one who is running. There's a fairly crowded field, isn't there?
There's a fairly crowded field, but not the ones who have made any official announcement. And in fact, most of the serious Republican candidates, or the ones people thought were serious Republican candidates, have dropped out of the race, like Mitch Daniels and Haley Barbour and so forth. So who they're going to end up with, I really don't know. And I think that Mitt Romney has got a serious problem. As John just said, he used to be a centrist, and of course most centrist Republicans have been driven out of the party long since. So his role as a centrist is kind of a lost one, and he's having to come out and explain why he was at one time in favor of gay marriage and why he was at one time in favor of a woman's right to choose and so forth and so on. And he's getting himself kind of tongue-tied in the process of trying to do something about it. So I don't really know what's going to happen, again, with the Republican field. I don't know who's going to emerge from that. It seems like their best and most logical people are dropping out, and I think probably realizing that President Obama is very likely to be reelected, and it's not going to be a good year for Republicans in that race. But who knows?
There's one other thing here, and again, this is bound to anger some of my Republican compatriots across the state. There's a dark secret in the party about Romney. There's a lot of fundamentalist Christians who don't trust Mormons. It goes way back in our history. And I have talked to Mormon Republicans, and they feel that. They feel that there's a prejudice there that's very hard to overcome. Obviously, they're God-fearing people who work hard. They're family-oriented people. Their values are very consistent with fundamentalist Christians. But there is, in the final analysis, an uneasiness in that community about Mormons. And it's deep and it's historic. And I think it's something that Romney struggles with. It's never brought out in the press. But I just think there's a suspicion about Mormonism that's deep and powerful, and may in the final analysis affect him in a place like, say, Iowa. Yeah.
I think so, too, and I think that's also affecting John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah.
Well, you know, Tim Pawlenty was the first GOP candidate to announce from Minnesota. You're John Smart, just not considering him a serious contender?
Gosh, it's so easy to overlook Teapaw, isn't it? Actually, I don't really consider Pawlenty to be a very serious contender. They might end up falling back on him because he's the only one who sounds reasonable, I suppose, to some degree. But he's not exactly doesn't attract a lot of lightning, let's put it that way.
You agree, John?
I liked him. I think he's a thoughtful guy. He's got good experience. I think sometimes, and I don't want to undermine him here in any way with the conservatives, he often sounds more conservative than his actual record in Minnesota was. He's very willing to work with Democrats at key moments to get legislation through. He largely had a good record in Minnesota, I think, which he even got the nod from Democrats for getting the job done. He's articulate. He's kind of a quiet man. He's not a grandstander. So if he was on the stage with Sarah and Donald, he's not going to go through sort of theatrics for us. But he's a very solid candidate. He simply doesn't have the name recognition right now that he'd need to move to the first row.
John Sharpless is a professor of history at UW-Madison, and John Smart is vice chair of the Price County Democratic Party. They are our two guests for this edition of The Week in Review. We will talk more national politics coming up after this break. We'll talk about the debate over the raising the debt ceiling. The House Republicans said no to raising the debt ceiling without trillions of dollars of budget cuts or spending cuts to go along with that. We'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about the top stories in state politics this week as well, including the latest news on the state budget and on recalls and recounts. 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 4 this afternoon, it's Your Views on the News with Gene Purcell in for Ben Marins. Gene and his guest will take your calls about what you see as the week's top news story. That's coming up, Your Views on the News, every Friday between 4 and 5 here on the Ideas Network. Every Friday between 8 and 9 each Friday morning, we have two guests from different political perspectives to review all the top political news stories of the week. And today we have with us John Smart and John Sharpless, and we welcome your input, too. Let's talk about the vote in the House to raise the debt ceiling. It failed without spending cuts. President Obama also met with House Republican leaders over this debate. The Republicans are insisting that there must be trillions of dollars of federal budget cuts before they agree to raise the debt ceiling. Where is this headed, John Sharpless?
I think this, you know, it's sometimes we live in a circus of politics. When I read about this introducing, the Republicans introduced the bill to raise the debt ceiling, and the congressman who introduces it and announces everybody should vote against it. The Republicans get on the phone and call up the Wall Street guys and say, this is just theatrics. Don't worry. We're really not going to mess with the national debt. You guys are going to be able to buy U.S. bonds in the future. And then out there, the Tea Party guys applaud this resistance on the part of they claim that the Democrats tried to force it through. And so it's really silly. I think what this was meant to be was a signal to Obama that they could do it. They could block raising the debt if they had to. That's why it was. But I'm not sure it really proves that. If it was a for real vote, I think you would have seen different numbers on it. Mm-hmm. I don't think, even if the president capitulates on cuts, that we can see a bill in time. Remember, it's August 1st for the debt limit crisis not to emerge. And it would be fundamentally irresponsible on the part of the Republican Party, something they may have to live with for decades, to completely implode our national credit over a presidential election.
So, John Smart?
I agree.
No, there we go.
Well, no, I agree completely. I just think that this was silly theatrics, and it accomplished absolutely nothing.
Let's take a call from Mark in Richland Center. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. I'm trying to figure this out. Every single dollar that's in existence is actually a debt. Every new dollar is a debt. It's all owed back with interest, but only the principal is put into the economy. So no matter what the spending level, high or low, if you spent every single dollar into that's in circulation to pay off the debt, we would be without a money supply and we would still be in debt because we borrow the currency itself into existence. Why does anybody think there is such a thing as getting out of debt when the very money system itself is based on debt? It's insane.
Is it insane? John Sharpless.
Well, I think Mark kind of has it right. If Mark means that we don't use gold and silver anymore as backing on our currency, and the currency is simply a pledge by the United States government, and by the way, all of us, that we will honor it, then it is, in fact, debt script. That is to say, it's issued by the government with a trust that it will be negotiated. I think he pushes that a little too far. I do think something should be said about debt. Clearly, there's good debt and there's bad debt. There's debt that when you borrow for infrastructure and the education of a next generation, you might even say that borrowing for a war, if the war is absolutely necessary, all of that's debt that's fully legitimate. The major problem with our government now is short-term debt. We literally have a weekly deficit. It's not an annual deficit. We're always behind on our income versus our expenditures. And the federal government steps into the short-term market. And that's where the federal government is the 90,000-pound gorilla, soaking up short-term credit, which should be going into business, and also raising money at higher interest rates than long-term debt. So I would say the real issue here is more about short-term debt than the issue of debt that has to do with infrastructure or education or long-run development.
Let's take another call from John in Appleton. Go ahead, John.
Yes, thank you. I guess one of the things that bothers me on this debt is the hypocrisy on the Republican side. So, you know, they all check out, oh, no, can't raise the debt limit. But in the Ryan budget that they all voted for, they're calling for $6 trillion of additional borrowing over the 10-year period. Guys, you can't have it both ways. Mm-hmm. And then in one of the provisions, they basically, in this vote, they tried to blame Obama for all the deficit problems. Sorry.
John Smart, you can respond to that.
Yeah, well, I would agree, of course. It seems like the national debt thing, and I also would like to comment on John's take on this being a temporary versus long-term debt, and I think that's a major issue that we need to consider. At the time that Bill Clinton left office, the short-term debt was pretty much erased, and we were operating in surplus, but that didn't last long, and now we're trying to dig our way back out again. If we could get the short-term debt under control, I think the long-term debt would take care of itself. But for the Republicans at this stage to be playing political games with the national credit rating, the faith and credit of the United States is extremely valuable. We're dealing with a situation internationally where the U.S. dollar is in danger of no longer being the currency of choice. The euro is having its own problems, so I'm not sure where we would go from there. But if the U.S. dollar is no longer considered to be the world's major currency base, I think that we will all be in serious trouble, and I hope that doesn't happen. But this, as I said, it's political shenanigans that they're playing with the debt crisis.
Let me get you both to quickly to respond to Representative Paul Ryan confronting President Obama this week, telling the president that he should stop calling the Medicare reform that Ryan is pushing, he should stop calling it a voucher program. And Republicans are saying that President Obama needs to stop the demagoguery over this issue. John Smart, is the president inaccurately portraying Paul Ryan's proposal to change Medicare?
I think it's kind of funny that Senator Ron Johnson also called it a voucher program. And he kind of stepped out of line a little bit there, but I thought that was pretty funny. And as far as demagoguing is concerned, I mean, every party does it. It's not the president. It's not just the Democrats. Who was talking about death panels and, you know, running, throwing grandma in front of the bus and all that stuff back when we were talking about the affordability health care program? So I just think that that's kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm. John Sharpless?
Well, you know, I'm in favor of throwing grandma under the bus if the if we would just stop wasting money on mass transit. look, at Paul's plan is not a voucher plan. You may have criticism with the restructuring of the plan. Here's what it is. It has to do with who the government pays. Paul has suggested that rather than paying the actual health care vendor, the hospital or the doctor or the clinic, that the government pays an insurance company that is selected by the Medicare recipient, which is very similar to the state program we have, the federal program that Congress has. It's the way most state medical plans are run. And the idea is, and let me say that I'm a friend of Paul's, and I really respect him on this. He might not be entirely correct, but what he thinks is if the government paid insurance companies, they would pay out a lot less, and then it would be a fully insurance-driven program, and those companies would actively work to reduce costs and put pressure on hospitals and vendors because they would want to make money. It may turn out that that's the case, that there are certainly cost savings that would occur if you had this secondary party in the system. It might turn out it just adds another agency to skim money. That is to say, it continues to cost a lot, and you just have insurance companies involved now. But it's not a voucher system. It absolutely is not. It simply says that the government wouldn't pay the vendors anymore. They would pay insurance companies, and the recipients would select the insurance companies. That's what his plan is. Hmm. It's certainly controversial. It would be a departure of from the current program. It's hard to know what the consequences would be. It's really quite radical, but it's not a voucher system.
We need to move on to some other issues as we are running out of time and a lot more in state politics that we need to talk about. Let's see, this week in state politics, the Government Accountability Board approved more recall petitions against three more Republican state senators, but delayed action on recalls against three Democrats.
Aha!
So indeed, that is prompting some groups to call for Kevin Kennedy, the head of the GAB, to resign, saying he's being politically biased in this. John Sharpless, is the Government Accountability Board pro-Democrat, anti-Republican?
Kevin Kennedy's been there for, two decades. He's an honest man. He tries really hard to be nonpartisan in an environment on a committee that tries to settle partisan disputes. I don't understand why only the Republicans have been approved and the Democrats have yet to be approved. I think if Kevin had been a little more politic, he would have kind of mixed the batch as they came out the end. My guess is that at the end, all of these recall races will be validated. It is a little embarrassing at this point that only the Republicans are under assault and the Democrats, at least at this moment, are safe from recall.
Yeah, what do you make of all this, John Smart?
Well, there have been an awful lot of stories about those three Democratic recalls, and I'm sure that John is aware of them, too. There were stories about people who were hired to collect signatures on these petitions who were from out of state. There's a famous story of one of them who was arrested for shoplifting in Lambeau Field. There was another story about one who was trading shots of whiskey in a saloon for people's signature on these petitions. And so there are a lot of questions about the petitions, especially on the ones in the Green Bay area and just west of there in Senator Holperin's area. A lot of those signatures are being challenged by citizens, and that's why there's the delay, because the in general, as I understand it, the ones on the repeal or recall for Republican members of the Senate were conducted mostly by local Democrats who were trying to protect their own seats or to get the Republicans out so that they can elect a Democrat to that seat. Whereas the Republicans seemed like they were hiring like bounty hunters to go out and collect signatures. And so a lot of those signatures are being questioned, and that's why Kevin Kennedy and his committee are under fire. And they have, as John just mentioned, Kevin Kennedy's been there for decades, and I think his nonpartisan credentials have been well established, and I think that this complaining business is kind of silly. I'm not sure where it's going to end up, and I would kind of assume that all six Republicans and the three Democrats will all face a recall election, but when that will be decided, I really don't know.
Yeah. I want to interject here. I don't think there's anything wrong with shots of whiskeys for signatures. As a man of Irish heritage, I think that's good politics. I just think there should be two shots.
Oh, no.
I don't think people should give away their signature so lightly.
Yeah, we talked to Mike Tate, the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, earlier this morning in advance of the Democratic Party convention that takes place today in Milwaukee, today and tomorrow. They're calling this the recall convention. He also predicts that when all is said and done, that we will have six Republican state senators facing recall this summer and three Democratic state senators facing recall this summer. But he is predicting that Democrats are going to prevail, that there will be enough of the Republicans ousted to cause Democrats to have control of the state Senate when all is said and done. Do you think so, John Smart?
Yes, I do. I think that the Democrats only need a net gain of three in order to take control of the Senate back, and I fully expect that to happen. There are several senators, Dan Capanke and some others, who I think are very, very vulnerable. And I think that for instance, in the Green Bay district, I think we've got a terrific candidate up there in Nancy Nussbaum, and there are a number of really good races being run. Sheila Harsdorff's got a very interesting challenger in Shelley Moore. I fully expect that the Democrats will indeed take back control of the Senate in the course of this recall series.
Mm-hmm. John Sharpless, do you think so?
I think Capanke could be in trouble. He barely won his first time out. I think he might have actually run more than once. He barely won his election over in La Crosse. Alberta Darling and Sheila Harsdorff are old-time Republicans. They've been elected time after time in their districts. I could be wrong. Sometimes you guess these things wrong. Maybe the level of anger out there is higher than I think. I really think they're safe. Whether or not the Democrats can squeeze out the three. Remember, they have to pick up three on the Republicans here and not lose any of those Democratic races. So I think it's a more difficult process than the leadership in the Democratic Party think it is.
We need to take a short pause. We will talk about more state politics when we return, including the official end of the state Supreme Court race. There will be no legal challenge. The challenger, Joanne Kloppenburg, conceded, and Justice David Prosser will be sworn in for another 10-year term later this summer. We'll talk about that issue and what the Joint Finance Committee is up to, and what protesters are up to as well, coming up during this edition of The Week in Review with John Sharpless, professor of history at UW-Madison, and John Smart, vice chair of the Price County Democratic Party. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org if you'd like to bring up a topic. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Veronica Rickert is with you, and Veronica and her guest will explore how President Lincoln used his words to fight the Civil War. That's coming up after 9 o'clock this morning. Time now for our Week in Review quiz. Donald Trump and Sarah Palin made some news this week after the two of them dined on pizza in New York City. Big deal, right? Well, it was a big deal to Daily Show host Jon Stewart.
Based on how you eat pizza, Donald, I want to see your long-form birth certificate. I don't think you were really born in New York.
So, what was wrong with the way Donald Trump was eating his pizza? If you think you know, you can call 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We will pick a correct answer from all of the correct answers. We'll pick a winner from all of the correct answers, and we will offer you the opportunity to pick from one of the many books that we featured on this program this week. So, what was wrong with the way Donald Trump was eating his pizza when he met with Sarah Palin this week at a pizza parlor in New York City? We'll give you about 5 minutes or so to call in your answer, and we'll announce the answer and the winner at the end of the program. All right, well, let's talk more about the news of the week with John Sharpless and John Smart, and get your reaction to the news that there will be no legal challenge of the state Supreme Court election recount. Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kloppenburg conceded defeat to incumbent David Prosser this week. John Smart, did she make the right decision, do you think?
Oh, I think so. I think it's time to call an end to it. But I think it's important that we did go through the procedure that we did, because I think everyone has questions about what happened in Waukesha County in particular, and the city of Brookfield. And I think it needed to be aired. And I think it's also interesting to point out that, you know, not that many months ago, it would have been assumed that David Prosser would have a free run at being reelected, and it didn't turn out to be that way at all. And I think it's a kind of a bellwether of the anger that is out there in the electorate right now. But I think that it was time for Joanne Kloppenburg to concede and to stop the process any further.
Mm-hmm. John Sharpless, was it worthwhile to have that recount, and was it the right decision to not challenge the results of the recount?
I agree. I think the recount, while I think most of us expected the result that came about, it was a confidence restorer. A lot of people on her side were very cynical about the lost ballots, the discovery of the ballots the next day, the fact that the number of ballots was almost precisely what Prosser needed to win. It turns out that was not criminal. It was incompetence. I can't believe they have a county clerk that's so incompetent. But as I mentioned last time I was on the show, I think it's funny that Republicans make such a big deal about Democrats and chicanery in elections, and it turns out it's a conservative that messes it up. It was necessary. Now it's over, I think, quite sensibly. She's moving on, and Prosser can get back to making whatever decisions he's going to make at the Supreme Court.
The Joint Finance Committee is hard at work trying to pass the Governor Walker's budget bill before the end of the week, hoping to approve all of this and move it on to the full legislature. Late last night, the Joint Finance Committee did approve a provision that would require new hires for local police and fire departments pay more for benefits, for their health benefits and their pension benefits, than those currently on the force, those currently on the force exempt from the collective bargaining restrictions that Governor Walker wants of all other public employees. Is this a big deal, John Smart, wanting new hires for police and fire departments to pay these more for their benefits?
Well, I think that what the Republicans in the legislature are trying to do is to counter the fact that the police and firemen were left out of the bill in the first place, because they were the only public employee unions that supported Scott Walker's election, and so they were automatically left off of the original bill. And I think that was kind of coming home to roost. The Republicans in the legislature were getting a lot of flack for that, so they thought they'd better include, in some way, they better include police and firemen. But it doesn't really change the story. The story being that they're out to essentially break union control in any circumstance or union involvement by doing it. excuse me. By doing it in regard to public employees, they hope to be able to extend that to private employees as well, is my take on it. And I think that it's a crazy scheme, and I'm not sure that it'll go very far. And it's also causing them serious drawbacks. I mean, there are an awful lot of people who are suddenly supporting teachers and public employees and so forth that probably a year ago would have scoffed at the idea that they would be called out to do that. I just think that this whole thing has caused a great deal more hullabaloo than anybody, Scott Walker or any of the Republicans in the legislature, ever expected that it would. And I think that it bodes well for the Democrats in the next election is what it does.
John Charbless?
Well, as we've talked before, it's a little close to home. I'm a public employee.
Yeah, I am too.
And I put in a lot of years. It's going on 40 years in public service in the state of Wisconsin. And for all my education, investment in my education, I don't earn a lot of money. For those out in TV land there, I don't own a big yacht. I sail at Hoofers down here in the sailing club for $150 a summer. And I was a bit shocked in the scapegoating of public employees on the part of Walker. It's one thing to say, you guys have to chip in a bit more, and I think most of us felt we had to. But to turn us into bad people, a bunch of deadbeats, kind of hurt my feelings. And it particularly hurt my feelings because not only am I a public employee, I ran for Congress as a Republican. So I think my credentials are certainly as good as Scotty's. I think the inclusion of the firemen and the police at this point is, as John said, is really an attempt to make up for what some people saw as special privilege. You donate to the Walker campaign and you're left out. This is a clumsy attempt to say it's not about campaign contributions. It's really about principle. Ultimately, I don't think it makes much difference. If I may say something about this public employees contributing more, I think the real thing that should have happened here is that it should have been progressive. I really think that for people like Barry Alvarez, who earn $500,000 of state money, he can afford to pay more. A janitor is pulling in $22,000 a year and he's got three kids, or a night nurse at an assisted care center who's pulling down $25,000. Let those people have what they have. I think this should have been graduated according to income. That would have been more humane. The people who are earning high state salaries could pay more. People who have a lot of people don't realize that many state employees, many of them, only earn in the 20s. And the only thing they get out of it is their health care and their pension. And those people are struggling, and they show up. You know, they're the custodians. They're the service people. They're the people who clean up the garbage. We need those people because our life is better because they show up every day, whether it's snowing or it's raining. And I would have liked to have seen this graduated according to income.
Let's talk a little bit about the chaos that erupted during the Finance Committee meeting last night. Police had to remove 25 protesters from that meeting. John Charbless, do you think the protesters are going too far here, or is this free speech at its finest?
I think there's a big risk here. I think many people across the state were very impressed with the large demonstrations. Despite some claims that there was disorderly conduct, I think overall we were told by public authorities in the city that people conducted themselves well. There's a risk here that the people who are in opposition to Walker and the Republicans will be viewed as troublemakers. And since this is kind of a battle for the will of the state, remember, one of the things that lies in the future for the anti-Walker people is that petition. I think it's very important that the protesters, the opposition, remain credible and not viewed as disruptive, a bunch of sort of hippies that are trying to damage the political process.
John Smart?
I think so, too. I think they have to be careful that they don't actually become the thugs and the slobs that Glenn Grossman and his pals were calling them. But I would go back to the original idea that these demonstrations, in a sense, woke up Wisconsin, and for that matter, woke up the nation. Wisconsin was in the front page of the news all over the United States and gave courage to a lot of other citizens around the nation to also stand up against this kind of action. And I think that that's a very healthy thing. People were talking, you know, the reason that they're trying to recall Senator Hansen and Senator Holperin and so forth is because they said that they skipped out on their job by going to Illinois, the fabulous 14. What they did was allow the citizenry of the state of Wisconsin time to react and time to respond to what was being pushed down their throats, and I think that that's a remarkable thing. And I would not want to in any way stifle that enthusiasm. I think that that's brought a new level of commitment from citizens across the state of Wisconsin and the nation. But I understand what John is saying, that there's a danger that if it's pushed too far, that they could just become a band of rowdy hooligans and so forth. And I don't think that that's happening. I think that they've been holding pretty firm about that. And I've heard stories from people who've been in Madison in the Capitol for these demonstrations, and they tell about kids going around with big garbage bags and picking up trash from the floor and doing various things like that to make sure that people were not, I mean, all of those silly reports that came out about how it was going to cost millions of dollars to clean up the Capitol building were just nonsense. And I think that it's important that people are aware of that. But I really think it's a healthy response. And I think that when the citizens of the state or of the nation are not responding in that way, then that's when we're in danger of being taken over by powers beyond our control.
I need to a caller who has been waiting with a budget issue, Pat in Brookfield. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys. I got to disagree real quickly with John a little bit. I mean, if you look at some of those pictures and some of the shakedown tactics of businesses, the unions, some of the people that have come in from out of state, I mean, yeah, there were a lot of teachers there locally and that kind of thing, but there has been a lot of nonsense going on, you know, just chance of shame every time a bill is passed.
Pat,
I think they might have jumped the shark. But what I wanted to say is, as far as the new W-2 program and the new welfare program, we have to realize that in Wisconsin, we have more generous social safety nets and benefits than every state, including Illinois. My sister was a social worker in Illinois. Now she is in Milwaukee. And I'm not going to generalize everybody, but she says year after year after year, she sees people that work for a week, so they apply for the earned income tax credit. They get, you know, between $5,000 and $10,000 because the state matches 55% of what the federal government already provides. They have to submit a W-2, simply, and they get that. They get free health care.
So you're all for cutting back on this, Pat. I'm very sorry. We have less than a minute for each of our guests to quickly respond. John Smart, the changes that Republicans are making to W-2 and the earned income tax credit?
I'm sorry. I really couldn't hear the caller very well. It was breaking up, and I don't. Could you give me a little more background?
He was all for cutting back on benefits for W-2 workers, and I'm just asking you your reaction. The GOP is changing the W-2 program, including a time limit on how long people can participate in the program and that sort of thing. Just so, was looking for your reaction to the changes to W-2.
I don't really have anything to add to that. I would point out, though, that the benefit packages that employees get, whether public or private employees, long ago, businesses and corporations and governments came to the realization that it was cheaper in the long run for them to provide pension programs and health care insurance programs for their employees. It was cheaper for them to do that than to give them more salary.
Yeah.
And that's essentially where all of that came from in the first place. We shouldn't forget that.
Yeah, we have less than 30 seconds to go. So, John Sharpless, very quickly, last word.
I want to know whether or not Donald Trump rolls his pizza or eats it.
Very good. Thank you for that transition.
Knife and fork.
Hey, there you go. What was wrong with the way Donald Trump was eating his pizza? He was eating it with a fork and he was stacking the slices. So we were accepting either answer. According to Stuart, true New Yorkers fold their slice in half with one hand and eat it. You don't stack it because apparently the steam from the bottom slice would ruin the crust on the top slice. So Trump defended his actions by saying he's not a crust man and that a fork allows him to eat just the toppings. So there you go.
It sounds un-American to me.
The winner of the quiz is Bill in Genoa City. Congratulations, Bill. We will offer you one of the books we featured on the program this morning. Thank you very much, John Sharpless and John Smart, for being with us for this edition of The Week in Review. We'll be back on Monday with more in our State Capitol Report between 7 and 8. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.